select English, and I would like to ask you to just return to the table. When we left off the other day, Representative Hoffman had a few questions which we didn't have time to get to, so I'd like to start off with Representative Hoffman. If you still have any questions.
Well, we got together and had an answer.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you.
Behind closed doors?
No, sir. No, sir. Oh, okay. No, sir.
Thank you for taking care of that matter and perhaps saving the committee some time. Were there any other members of the committee that had questions for Commissioner-elect or designee or whatever your title is these days?
I'm not sure yet.
Representative.
So I'll wish you last problem.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, my gosh.
That takes care of that problem.
We're going to try, put it that way.
Okay, Representative Menard.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm sure it's going to be a little redundant, but maybe I should short. How are we coming out on the cuts as far as the trooper on the street? You know, meaning in the department, how many cuts are we going to have, and what's the effect going to be on the trooper on the street?
I can't answer at this particular time. It's going to be, I won't say substantial. It's going to be, it's going to affect all of us, everybody. It's going to increase the workload on the existing personnel. There's no question about it. Not only on the blue shirt, the trooper side, but also the Fish and Wildlife side, the traffic protection side. Also the division of the motor vehicle side. We just have less money, as you know, about $25 million less. So it's going to affect our operation overall. Hopefully, not to the point it's going to be dangerous to anybody. Thank you.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner English, when it comes to prioritizing what resources you have in terms of utilization of the troopers, I know in Kodiak there is not sufficient coverage of the area outside the city limits, and I'm talking just the road system outside the city, for a trooper beyond 24 hours a day. And I recall a situation where some people's life was threatened. Life was not threatened, but there was a firearm incident, and they came in to lodge a complaint, and they had to come back at 8 o'clock the next day to talk to the troopers. And I was just wondering, you know, in your own program, how you would, you know, what are some of the ideas, or how are some of the priorities established as far as what you will be doing in regards to a shortage of manpower?
That's terrible. We have it, and we kind of relate to that, if I may, and I hate to go back to the old days, but I'm just going to have to do it somewhat. I think that's probably one reason I'm here now is in the old days when we had any particular call that involved life, I mean, it didn't make any difference if you worked 8 hours or 24 hours, you always responded. That was a necessity. We still do that, but there are restrictions. As you know, we have contracts now. We didn't have in the old days. Contracts, a agreement with our people, and I'm not saying that that's bad now either, by the way. But what really upset me not too long ago is I was in Soldovia, where I'm from. But my wife, I was coming down the next day, and we had some flooding that was taking place, hard rains in the Kenai Peninsula. I says, call the state troopers and get a road report before you leave Anchorage. So the next morning, she called the state troopers and got a road report. They told her when she called, she says, well, we can't give you that information. Call the radio station. She said, well, this is the state troopers, isn't it? She said, yeah. Well, she said, you have to call the radio station. We just can't give you that kind of information. That's very minor from what you're talking about, but that's a basic, the same thing. I mean, that's what we're there for. That's why we're in business. And we still have people out on the road. We still have radio equipment, and we still have all these things. But we were getting out of the idea of really servicing the public, and that's what we're charged to do as state troopers and Fish and Wildlife officers and the Department of Public Safety. It doesn't really answer how I prioritize it. It just answers that I feel a very strong urge to provide a service to the people, and that's why I agreed to accept this position. Beyond that, I can't prioritize. We are going to do that. I'll just...
Thank you.
Any other questions? I'll just take a moment to raise one.
fire chiefs in Anchorage a month ago or so when they were having a training session up there, and that issue did come up. Since then, I have had a chance to talk to our people, and also our training, our fire training director, and that would definitely assist the department in providing fire training not only to the, well, throughout the state, and it would certainly assist our department in the obvious budget shortfall area. I'm not sure what the stand of anybody is on it, except I personally, not knowing the ins and outs like you do, personally like to see some additional funds in that area. If that doesn't answer the question, but it's kind of
it's around close enough. Okay, thank you very much for joining us again this afternoon. Appreciate your taking the time to do so.
Thank you.
Could I have a motion?
I'll move the nomination of Mr. Nashor, Commissioner of Public Safety.
Is there anyone who objects to the committee's recommendation? If not, we will be recommending that you be approved. Okay, the next item before us is House Bill 217, an act relating to the purchase of foreign investments by the Board of Trustees in the Alaska Permanent Fund. And I believe we have several people. William Means, would you like to be first? Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the House State Affairs Committee, before I begin my presentation, I should like to say that House Bill 217 was drafted and sponsored at the request of the Board of Trustees of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Mr. Means, just to clarify, you do work for the Alaska Permanent
yes.
Fund, not for the
Department. My position with the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is the Chief Investment Officer. Why foreign investments? This is a question that wouldn't even have arisen 20 years ago, certainly not in these legislative chambers, or I might add in the legislative chambers of any other legislature in the country. In 1967, the United States financial markets represented over two-thirds of the world's equity market capitalization, and the United States was the world's unquestioned financial and industrial leader. By the end of 1985, it represented less than 50% of the world's equity market capitalization, and this percentage continues to shrink. Although we do not have current figures, one would have to assume that the recent substantial U.S. dollar decline has resulted in a further substantial shrinkage of this percentage. I think it would be better actually a bit earlier on. The world's investable capital markets, excluding cash and real estate, totaled some $10 trillion as of December 1985. The world fixed income market bonds amounted to some $6 trillion. While the world equity markets, common stock markets, amounted to some $4 trillion. Some statisticians are projecting that by the year 2000, world GNP will be over $15 trillion, with 75% of the world GNP outside the United States. With the breakdown of exchange controls and rapid technological advances in communication, the internationalization of the world's financial markets has been proceeding at a rapid pace. In 1973, when I moved to Germany, television news was delayed at least a day, and all scheduled programs were delayed a week. The tapes had to be flown to Juneau from Seattle, and not infrequently, bad weather delayed their arrival. Our only access to current world news in the financial markets was a telephone. Today, thanks to satellite communications, the Permanent Fund Corporation has instant access not only to world news, but also to the world's financial markets. In our office in Juneau, each of our investment offices has two television monitors on which we are able to obtain Reuters and Telerate financial services. We have instant access to the stock market, the U.S. government bond market, foreign exchange quotations, the commodities markets, financial futures, worldwide financial news, and trading in U.S. government bonds in Tokyo and London, as well as New York. The rapidity with which the world has been shrinking has been truly breathtaking. Worldwide global telecommunications and the integration of the world's financial markets is no longer a dream, but well on the way to accomplished fact. During the past 16 years, a period of explosive change, the non-U.S. markets have offered significant investment opportunities for U.S. investors. These opportunities can be seen in the form of return enhancement and risk reduction. A number of statistical studies have shown definite benefits from foreign investment, both in the level of return and the reduction of risk. The degree of benefit demonstrated varies from one study to another, depending upon the particular time span used, the countries covered, and the types of investments. But the positive conclusions persist through all of them. Now, here we have the total annual rate of returns in U.S. dollars on a number of markets throughout the world, including the Standard & Poor's 500, for the period 1976 through 1985. You'll notice, here we are, 1976 through 1985. The best performer appears in blue. The worst performer appears in pink. Over here we have the Standard & Poor's 500. You'll notice during this period, 1976 to 1985, only in 1 year, 1982, did the U.S. market, as represented by the Standard & Poor's 500 index, outperform the rest of the world's market. Contrary-wise, only 1 year was it the worst performer. Several interesting things that can be noted here. How fast markets can change. In 1976, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, had the worst performing market, a negative 12.7%. But the following year, it had the best performance, a 58% rate of return. But generally, you'll notice that the statistics are rather, the best and the worst are scattered pretty much all over the world's financial markets. Some other statistics here are rather interesting. For the period 1976 to 1980, the worst performer for that 5-year period was Germany. The best performer was Hong Kong, with a 36.2% rate of return. For the period 1981 to 85, Singapore had the worst return, a negative 5.8%. And the best performer, Germany, with 24.6%. So they were 1976 to 1980, they were the worst performer for that 5-year period. For the succeeding 5-year period, they were the best performer. And for a 10-year period, 1976 to 1985, the worst performing nation was Australia. A negative 10.3 rate of return, and the best performer was Japan with a 20% rate of return. U.S. international equity market, stock market, common stock market, performance comparison. We are comparing the Morgan Stanley Capital International Europe Australia Far East Index versus the Standard & Poor's 500 Index. This is an index that is constructed of stocks in this Europe, Australia, and the Far East in a similar manner to the manner in which the Standard & Poor's 500 is constructed. On the left-hand side, you'll notice we have the cumulative returns in U.S. dollars. You can use a dollar, $100, $1,000. For a 10-year period ending December 79, December 80, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85. Let's assume an investment of $100 for the 10 years ending December 79, the total cumulative return in dollars would have been $159 on $100 investment. That is for the Europe Australia Far East Index. For the Standard & Poor's Index for the same period, it would have been $76. For the 10 years ending December 1980, Europe Australia Far East Index would have returned $261, and the Standard & Poor's 500 would have returned $144.
you'll notice that in every year, the Europe Australia Far East Index exceeded the Standard & Poor's, and the best the Standard & Poor's could do was match only in the year, the 10-year span ending December 1984. International common stock or equity market return annualized for the 16 years ending, beginning 1970 and ending 1986. For that period of time, in dollars, the U.S. stock market provided an 8.7 rate of return. Japan, 20.9. The United Kingdom, Great Britain, 11%. Germany, 11.8. And all of the rest of the world, as represented by the Capital International World Index, excluding the United States, provided a rate of return of 13.4%. So the U.S. market was the worst performer for the 16-year period. Now we have international equity markets, the common stock market, standard deviation of return in the U.S. dollars. Now, standard deviation of return is simply a measurement of risk. Risk as determined by volatility, movement up and down as on a statistical basis for the period 1970 to 1986. The higher the number, the greater the the higher the percentage, the greater the volatility of the individual markets. And as when we say greater volatility, we're defining that as risk. The U.S. was 15.7%, Japan 23%, the United Kingdom was 27.9%, Germany was 20%, and all the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., was 16.2%. So risk, as defined by volatility in each one of these separate markets and the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., was higher than the U.S. So when you combine the U.S. and the non-U.S., you produce a standard deviation of return, a rate of risk, that is lesser than the U.S. That doesn't seem possible, but you have to realize that markets around the world do not move in coordination. Some markets move quite closely to the U.S. stock market, or if the U.S. stock market goes up, they go up, and generally in the same percentage factor. But a number of the world's markets, the further you get away from the U.S., do not. For example, Hong Kong has a very low correlation, the correlation of return relative to the U.S. We'll look at those figures again. But the interesting fact here is that if you combine all of the world's markets outside the U.S. with the U.S., you will produce a lower risk than you do in just the U.S. market alone. Again, we'll look at the international equity common stock market annualized local and currency returns, 1970 to 1986. The gold being the local rate of return, the pink being the currency impact on the rate of return, and then above the local rate of return. The U.S. for this period, we have for the 16 years, 1970 to 1986, an 8.7% rate of return. Obviously, there's no currency factor since we're converting all these into U.S. The local currency for Japan was 15.4% rate of return, substantially above the U.S., and the currency added an additional factor of 4.8%, so you actually had a total rate of return for this period in Japan when you added the currency factor in of 20.2%. Great Britain, the local rate of return was 14.1%, but the currency was a negative, a minus 2.3%. But even taking into consideration the currency factor, you still had a rate of return that was superior to the rate of return in the U.S. Germany, 8.4% in the local currency. Again, the currency had a positive factor here, raising and providing a superior rate of return above the U.S. And likewise with the non-U.S., all the rest of the world, excluding the U.S. The interesting factor is how little the currency really impact has in the total rate of return over an extended period of time. Now we're going to look at the international fixed income or bond market, annualized returns in U.S. dollars for the period 1970 to 1986. In the 16-year period of the United States, 9.4% rate of return, Japan 13.8%, United Kingdom 8.2%, Germany 12.3%, and all of the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., 11.8%. Only the United Kingdom provided a lower rate of return than the U.S. did. Now we're going to look at the standard deviation of return, again, a measure of risk for the period 1970 to 1986. U.S. 9.4%, Japan 13.4%, Great Britain 16.3%, Germany 14.4%, all the rest of the world 11.1%, and the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., 8.3%. So the standard deviation of risk, again, like in the equity market, we find that the standard deviation of risk for the United States, for Japan, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., in each instance was higher than the U.S. But when you combined it with the U.S., with the non-U.S., with the U.S., the world rate of return, the risk factor, is lower. This time, we'll look at at the bond market, the annualized local and currency returns for the period 1970 to 1986, and look at the impact of the currency. 9.4% rate of return for the U.S., Japan 8.6%, but the currency increased the yield substantially above the U.S. The United Kingdom, once you took the currency factor in, reduced it so just slightly below the U.S. level. Germany 8.9%, currency factor raised it above the U.S. level. And the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., slightly below the U.S., but the currency factor raised it above the U.S. I think the conclusion that can be drawn here, as contrary to the common stock markets, the currency becomes a much more important factor when dealing with the bond market. Now, as I mentioned earlier, correlation of returns between U.S. and major foreign markets. Well, these are percentages. 0 up to 50% on this side, and these are the markets we're dealing with: Canada, Netherlands, Switzerland, UK, France, Australia, Singapore, Germany, Japan, Hong Kong, and then the Europe, Australia, Far East Index. The correlation of return between the U.S. and the Canadian stock market, how do they move in sympathy with each other? Since Canada is one of our largest trading partners, if not the largest, and that our industry is pretty much works hand in hand with much of Canadian industry, for example. Many U.S. cars are assembled in Canada. Components of U.S. cars are made in Canada. You would expect that the markets would move with a great deal of similarity. And here you do find we're approaching a 50% correlation between the Canadian stock market and the U.S. stock market. But when we move down out here, Singapore, Switzerland, Singapore, Japan, and Hong Kong, you find a very low correlation in return. Hong Kong is approximately 5%, as opposed to Canada's 50%. In fact, and then you have the Europe, Australia, Far East Index at approximately 17% when you combine all of them. So what the thing to be drawn from this is that the stock markets of the world go to the tune of different drummers, and that the U.S. stock market may be going up, but you may find at other times that other stock markets around the world are going down. Contrary-wise, when the U.S. stock market is going down, it's very weak. You're going to find some other stock markets that are performing very well around the world. Now, this looks a bit complicated, but it's very understandable when we take a look at it. On the left-hand side, we have rates of return, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16. The higher we go up the left, the higher the rate of return. Is that clear? Can you read it all right? As we look to the bottom, this is your annual standard deviation of return. The further you go to the right, the greater the rate. The higher you go up, greater the rate of return, further you go to the right, the greater the risk. The blue dots represent the 100% weighting of a portfolio in the Standard & Poor's 500 index. The orange dot represents 100% weighting in the Europe, Australia, Far East index. And the green dot represents the optimum mix of the S&P and Europe, Australia, Far East index, for which risk is minimized. So we'll take a look here. We have a 14% rate of return in 1985 for a 100% portfolio weighted 100% in Standard & Poor's 500 index, with a risk of 14%. That deviation of risk of 14%. 100% Europe, Australia, Far East index and portfolio, which implied a rate of return higher than the 14%, 16% rate of return, but a higher standard deviation of risk of 15%. But a 60-40 allocation between the two portfolios in the portfolio would increase the rate of return, and at the same time, reduce the risk. We have raised the dot of the 100% U.S. portfolio, and at the same time, we have moved it to the left, so we have reduced the risk. Mm-hmm. In each instance, in no instance, for the period of 1979 to 1985, does a portfolio mixture, the optimum portfolio mixture, result in a reduced rate of return. And in every instance, it results in a reduction of risk for the entire portfolio.
Bill, just to clarify that one slide, I guess in simple language, the rate of return has increased significantly, and the rate of risk has decreased significantly if you mix your portfolio of approximately 60-40.
No, in different years, this is the 60-40, 70-30. These are the optimum portfolio mixtures for each year.
Thank you.
Obviously, we don't know what that is at the time. You only know that by hindsight.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right.
Today, global investing isn't restricted only to a few companies. It includes most of the world's major industries. The number one oil company in the world today is Exxon. The numbers 2 and 3 are both foreign, the Royal Dutch Shell Group and British Petroleum. The two largest food companies in the world are European, Unilever of Dutch and British ownership, and Nestle, a Swiss concern. The number 2 and 3 chemical companies in the world behind DuPont are German, Bayer, and Hoechst. And the top 4 banks today are Japanese, Daiichi Kangyo, Fuji, Sumitomo, and Mitsubishi. Some of the most significant research for modern wonder drugs has been undertaken by a number of major Swiss and British pharmaceutical firms. Currently, the world is involved in fierce economic competition to determine which companies will be the winners in the fields of capital goods, consumer electronics, and telecommunications. A large number of the most rapidly growing firms are situated outside the United States, reflecting fast-expanding overseas markets, abundant supply, overseas supplies of industrial raw materials, and of labor of various skill levels. In some instances, investors can only participate in certain areas of technology by investing in foreign firms. Certain areas, for example, combat disc recorders, none are made in the United States. VCRs, none are made in the United States. Over the most recent 10-year period, the Standard & Poor's 500 has managed a very healthy compounded rate of return of 13.5% annually. The Capital International Europe Australia Far East Index has returned an annual 20% for the same period. The next decade may be just the converse, with the S&P earning a 21% rate of return and the Europe Australia Far East Index at 13.5%. Even if this is the case, one can be fairly certain that there will be countries, securities, and whole asset classes that will outperform the U.S. for periods of time during the next decade. The United States' inability to stand apart from the rest of the world has
an independent entity is above all the reason to factor international investment into investment funding. In addition, a number of analysts suggest that the prudent man rule and the prudent expert rule require investors with fiduciary responsibility to look carefully at developments worldwide and to put in place plans for an uncertain future, a future of unpredictable global influence on investments. We don't know how the U.S. market will compare to foreign markets over the next 20 years. The analysis of international markets should be embraced because it can protect a securities portfolio against disaster. Uncertainty about the future should impel investors to diversify as widely as possible. And that concludes my presentation. Madam Chair, do you have any questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. It's been a very interesting presentation. It, I must confess, does not inspire confidence in the U.S. economy to see those numbers so graphically displayed. Yeah. Are there any questions, Mr. Mayor?
I think we all know that generally that foreign markets are probably better, but that our discussion will probably be more political than it would be when we out here making a dollar for the sake of the dollar. And I'm wondering if the group has looked into the various countries to say, certainly we stay away from these countries because of their disability to not cater into the free enterprise system or things like that.
Madam Chair and Representative Martin, I would assume that if this bill were passed, that the Board of Trustees would become very much involved in making these determinations. And the Permanent Fund Corporation has requested for the next fiscal year, for the purposes of this bill is passed, $35,000. And this fund would be utilized almost exclusively for investigations into the manners of investing. There are several different techniques that can be used for investing. For one thing, we can use an index, similar to the Capital International Index, to replicate the results. We can use investment advisors and managers separately. They can be given instructions as to various areas of the world, but there would be an extended period of time of investigations, which the Board of Trustees would be very actively involved in bringing in outside experts. For example, I am quite certain in my own mind that such countries as South Africa would be excluded from investment. Certainly other areas of the world. But on the other hand, you have to realize there are risks in this country, too. People that invested in LTV bonds suddenly found that the company was bankrupt. So there are risks in this country as well as risk investing internationally. The idea is that if you diversify widely enough, you reduce these risks. And that's the point of the
I wasn't thinking of the list of pure enterprise system going on. I was thinking of the list of the political instability of certain countries, and perhaps if the board would say, look, these are the first countries we're looking into, about 20 countries, and we're going to stay away from the politically volatile areas where it comes to the instability of a political system, that you know, they may be free enterprise today, but they may be completely socialistic tomorrow, that we're out of everything. That would be part of your
Madam Chair, Representative Martin, I'm certain that the Board of Trustees would look very thoroughly at the countries and would determine whether they felt that these were acceptable from their own, in their own minds, both politically as how the public would view it, and from the point of view of these risks, both internal and external risks.
Yes, in your trading on the world market, as I understand it here, when we want to move in or out of a particular area in the United States market, how is a trade transacted here? I'm talking about the mechanics of it. Do you computerize the trade? Does it go out via satellite, responded via satellite?
Madam Chair, Representative Boucher, I would assume in most instances, certainly with the common stock, that this would all be handled by managers outside. None of the I can't imagine any of the equity managing being done in state. We currently do not manage any of our domestic equities in state. So So we would be looking to firms that have an established position and established reputations worldwide for managing equity.
Okay, in this country or in the other country? Say, for example, we were trading heavily on the Japanese stock market. Would that investment come by here and into Japan? Mm-hmm. Say, San Francisco to Japan, or would it be going directly to Japan?
I would imagine, Madam Chair, Representative Boucher, again, these are areas that would have to be discussed in extent, great extent by the trustees, but many of the international investment management firms have offices in New York, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and have offices all over the world. So like a firm such as Morgan Guaranty, for example, has offices all over the world. It would probably be run from Morgan Guaranty New York, and they would direct their other offices. But each one of these firms, we're dealing with different relationships. It would have to be viewed carefully and discussed closely by the board of trustees.
Madam Chair, I think the thing that I'm trying to get at here is when we're trading on the New York Stock Exchange and the American Stock Exchange, we all realize President Reagan makes a statement and stocks go up and down. And I know that we're not trading and buying and selling and so forth. But and that's a part of the picture, and people here can be somewhat aware of it. I'm sure that the executive director keeps as much on top of it. Now we move into a market like Japan, and let's say, for example, the recent microchip thing, where they were dumping microchips on the world market. And obviously, it's got some repercussions. Would we be able to pick that up as close to the reaction as possible?
We would expect our, Madam Chair, we would expect our investment managers to pick it up and keep us advised, yes.
Yeah, okay. And they would have offices in Tokyo, and they would be...
Well, most of these firms do have offices in Tokyo.
Most of these firms do.
I can't say all because I don't know what the universe we're looking at, you know, what the Board of Trustees, I can't commit them, but I, Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any major money manager that does not have offices in the major financial centers in the world. And I cannot imagine that we would, that the Board of Trustees would select a firm that did not have people on site in these countries.
That's my point. I'm sure they would be looking. I just wanted to ask that question.
Anything else about Representative Boucher? Sure.
Yes, thank
you.
Yes. Fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, the way it is set up now is we're investing the funds in like common stocks and other stock exchanges, but are we purchasing any foreign stocks at all through the New York Stock Exchange for all U.S. companies?
Madam Chair, the interpretation of the law is that we can only invest in domestic U.S. companies. And in a few instances where managers have made mistakes and invested in firms that are listed on the New York Stock Exchange but are foreign firms, I think there was one problem with Schlumberger. There was a request to liquidate.
I guess, you know, what it comes down to, Madam Chair, in my personal opinion, if you're looking at it from the pure capitalistic standpoint, you know, it makes sense to invest in the world markets. And like, I guess the only struggles I have is the philosophical side of it, using our dollars and looking at, you know, what kind of responsibility we have as far as investing in our own country and keeping our own jobs and being involved in that process. Now, I do know, you know, you're looking at your slides and the whole business that you showed, economically, it may not be the wisest thing. I guess the only struggle I have is the personal philosophy of it. You know? So I just want to share that point.
Madam Chair, if I might make some comments. As the world grows, again, two-thirds of the world at one point, two-thirds of the GNP, two-thirds of the capital of the world, in the United States. it did not make sense to invest outside. But if we're looking at a world where 75% of the economic activity is outside the United States, one of the cardinal principles of prudent investment is diversify your portfolio. Are we diversifying our portfolio if we do not invest outside the United States? I understand what you're saying. There will be no time, I could imagine, that we're not going to have a heavy investment in the United States. But, for example, I might bring out some figures here I have. I got these figures from the Department of Revenue. I believe it was 1982 legislation that was presented to the legislature requesting authority for the Public Employees and Teachers Retirement System, and in addition, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, to invest in foreign securities. The legislature at that time passed a bill for the public employees and teachers that deleted the Permanent Fund Corporation. And from the period of the first inception of foreign equity, of foreign common stock, many of the very large portfolios in this country that have invested have actually, that have provided superior rates of return, have had a component of international investment.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think you've addressed a lot of my concerns, the political risk factor, the expertise that you would utilize in getting involved in foreign investment. And of course, the main concern of, you know, how would you deal with the explanation of abandoning the U.S. and Alaska in your investment policy. But, and you also touched upon the other public and as well as private money managers and investors. I was just wondering if, in fact, we do pass this, and apparently from what you've just said, if we had done all of our investing abroad, you're talking the 45 and the 20, if I understood you correctly, the permanent fund would be twice of what it is now, approximately, if we had done that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the rate of return on that portion that was invested foreign would have been twice as, it would have been over twice as much on the basis if we were invested exactly like the two retirement systems. However, we wouldn't have had a twice rate of return because we had never had 100% commitment or anywhere near that. I think you're probably talking if authority is granted by the legislature, first a year would be a year of study, and we would move very cautiously into international investment, just as the fund has moved very cautiously into domestic common stock investment. The most we have is, at any one time is 20%, and this was developed over slow and regular investment over, say, approximately 3 years. So there would be no sudden movement. It would be slow, steady, moving to it.
So then my question is, have you discussed a percentage of what foreign investment would be of the total fund investments? Have you talked about in diversifying the portfolio to include foreign investment? Have you talked about any kind of percentage?
Madam Chair, no, we have not discussed any percentage.
Thank you.
I believe there is a percentage ceiling on the second page of the bill.
Yes.
No more than 20% by region. Representative Martin, and then Mr.
Carter. I'm not against going into foreign investment at all, but I was wondering if perhaps our guideline now, where we say the prudent man investment, should be changed to perhaps what some people consider a little more conservative concept, and that's the prudent expert concept that California uses in its investment. Basically, what you do between the two is that the prudent expert man concept is supposed to be less speculative, and therefore you as a board would judge as an individual who invests their own monies under the principles of everything but speculation, less speculation. Does that make it clear, the two concepts?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, the prudent expert rule is my understanding from the information I have obtained basically states that you will involve experts in your decision-making process. However, what would constitute, and I might add that we do, in the Board of Trustees, in every decision-making process, does involve experts. So you're not really requiring anything more restrictive than what the Board of Trustees is imposing upon itself. The allocation, you have experts brought in, the asset allocation, you have experts brought in. This is done regularly, once a year, a full consideration of this. It's usually a two-day meeting, and it is brought up periodically at regular board meetings. But as far as what constitutes an expert, there is a lot of give and take. I might be considered an expert. Any of our investment officers might be considered an expert. Members of the boards of trustees could be considered experts. There is a lot of, hasn't been any definitive determination by the courts as to what is an expert. So it's a little more open than it might appear.
It wasn't a matter of, that you, I'd assume in reading your records that you're using some really complex expert in the nation. And I would mainly say that we need to change that, although they're doing it in practice, should it be a word that allowed the investment board here in the first place. But if you're using it, it's a minor thing. What's an expert? I guess you're an expert as long as you keep on making money and doing what you lose.
Let's see, Representative Huffman.
I guess I have the similar concern that Representative Menard has, you know, when the American textile industry is taking out ads and putting out clothing, Buy USA, you know, and Buy American cars. And, you know, I think that by, even though we may go in and diversify the portfolio slowly in the foreign, into foreign investments, that will take dollars out of investing in the United States. And I guess that does have some concern, but to me, but where has the board contemplated which areas that it would not concentrate on? You know, which part in your portfolio, you already say that you spend so much in the Midwest, a substantial portion in the East, you diversify it. Substantial portion of the funds are in treasury notes and bonds, and marketing, repurchase agreements, certificates of deposit. It seems to me that you know, we as a legislature aren't going to get into what the board is going to invest in, but when you present this type of a proposal, I guess it would be helpful to me to know just which areas the board is going to be concentrating on, and which in the foreign market, and which areas are going to be less concentrated on in the American market.
Madam Chair, I might just start off by saying, for example, in some instances, the fund, by not being invested in foreign securities, let's say foreign fixed income securities, the fund has lost a lot of purchasing power in terms of what worldwide it would have. For example, if you had invested in German government of West Germany treasury notes, for example, let's say 2 years ago, you would have, those bonds would be worth approximately 40% more in dollars than our U.S. treasury notes, simply because of the deterioration in the value of the dollar. So I think the legislature has to make some determination as to which interests I understand, and I agree, and I personally agree that we should support U.S. industry, but there is also a responsibility to the, as a fiduciary in the management of the trust. Now, although we have spelled out specific maximums in the bill, that to invest in, first of all, one would have to assume we're not going to go to the maximum in all of them. And for one example, we have had the authority for, I think, for approximately 3 years to buy certificates of deposit of U.S. banks in Europe that are denominated in U.S. dollars. We've had the authority. We have never utilized it because we have not thought this was the place to be. And I would think that the trustees, again, are going to look at the overall picture. They're not going to say, we want a lot of foreign bonds, we want a lot of foreign stocks, and we're going to go over everything. They're going to review the market. They're going to bring in the opinion of experts. And at that point, they're going to make a decision after listening to all of the pros and cons of the market. And you may find that we will have a number of experts. For example, Japan right now, the Japanese stock market is very, in the opinion of many people, is a very seriously overpriced market. The board might decide to stay out of the Japanese market entirely. But changing circumstances are going to alter their opinions, and they're going to listen to their advisors and in the investment market. They're not going to feel competent in making these decisions on their own without a lot of outside expert advice.
Your response seems too general. You know, you already said that, well, we wouldn't be contemplating investing in South Africa. You know, that's the specifics that I would like you to respond to my original question.
Well, Madam Chair, I just think that I just spoke, maybe I spoke out of turn on this part of the board, but I would assume that considering the political controversy that has surrounded this area and the strong opinions that different people hold and the moral issue that's involved, the board of trustees would not feel comfortable. I can't say they definitely would not, but I don't think they would feel comfortable investing.
Yeah, I'll try and you might write these down because they're all related to each other. It was, how many states that have funds now, if you don't have that, could you surprise the list of investing in foreign investments? And would the company that is recommended be located, have a branch office in Anchorage? My reason for that is because obviously, you know, the market opens in New York at a certain time. And as we are finding out in the Winter Olympics, our geographical location presents certain advantages to us in the Olympics. And I'm wondering if that might not be true in the world trading market, too. And I've often thought one of the power of money, Governor Cooper has talked about Anchorage being a world a trading center, but let's say, for example, if we began and it was noted in the foreign markets that Alaska was becoming a trader in those markets, might that increase our opportunity in areas of economic development? I've often felt, not politically, but there's certain levers that might be applied by the large amounts of investments. I realize that touches just a little bit on the political side, but would there be some opportunities that could accrue back to Alaska in the turn of enhancing our Pacific Rim positions? And then one thing that I would say, for, you know, you're talking about the trade in the world market, just a comment on what you two, if one will read the book The Reckoning by David Halberstam that's just recently on the market, you'll see the bad need for us really to get competitive in this world market. Almost the telecommunications and the electronic transfer of money, there's probably more money in the sky than our gross GNP just about demands that we have some involvement in this, in the picture, but so much for that. It's just, I would kind of like to know that. If you don't have all the answers now, fine.
So it means it is my intent to wrap up the discussion on this today and return to this subject on Friday, so I guess I would just ask you if you would prepare any answers to those questions. Representative Davidson had another question, and if some of the other members have specific questions that you would request that Mr. Means return to us on Friday with, either ask him now or perhaps communicate with him independently.
I will yield to Madam Chair.
Okay. I guess one final clarification on the fiscal note, just in case something needs to be done between now and then. The $45,000, which is indicated for FY88, you have explained in terms of some research which you feel the trustees needs as a first step. What about the $500,000 that appears every year thereafter?
That would, Madam Chair, that was assumed to be manager's fees for managing the portfolio. Management and the actual investment, the fees, transaction fees, carrying fees, custodian fees for safekeeping.
Okay, not to come out of the general fund.
Not out of general fund. The state's fund.
Clarification on the source of.
Well, everything is appropriated. That it would be appropriated from the, I assume all the funds are appropriated as the program funds.
Thank you. I guess I would like some additional information. I guess it comes to the legislature for approval, but the source of the funds
is the portfolio itself. Yeah.
Okay. All right, any other questions? If not, we will. Yes, Representative Hubbard.
Along the same lines, I guess, the if we diversify, are we saying that it's going to cost us an additional $500,000 a year starting in 1989 versus investing in the United States?
No, it would not. Necessarily, if we increased our investments in the United States, we would also have an increase in expenditure on the basis of the manager's require. The management fees are normally determined by the amount of money involved at the end of the year, at the market value, it's usually a percentage. So if we increase, this is assuming that these foreign investments would be an investment above and beyond what the common stock investments, domestic common stock investments are.
So my question is, this new dollars that we're, you know, earnings that we're getting that are resulting in the fiscal note, or is it because of diversification?
It's a diversification, an investment, additional investment in common stocks. In other words, we will not be selling domestic common stocks necessarily to invest in foreign common stocks. And the management fees on common stocks are substantially higher, and the expertise is required is substantially higher, and the clearing fees are substantially higher than for bonds.
I guess it might be helpful to clarify if you...
Thank you.
press some good news for them. We paid our money for that better than 6 weeks of performance, and we have decided that we can buy a marmot fur hat and put for
I
concern is that it would be nice to have some type of figure out there that is stable and level in terms of the years that we all and in conjunction with labor and conditions that we need to take those things and do what we're considering this dilemma, I asked for a research project to be done by the House Research Agency, which revealed that some 9 other states do allow their Supreme Courts to issue advisory opinions. Madam Chair, it's courts only address, under common law, courts only address issues in controversy. In other words, there has to be a case brought before them
There's a good reason for that, because in our, you know, our three branches of government, our tri-government system, we don't want courts going out and deciding issues on their own unless there's a controversy in existence, because then they'll become similar to a legislative body making their own law. But if several states have recognized that there are conditions where it's good to have the advice of your court before you jump into an issue, and you may save a lot of money and a lot of people's time by having that advice ahead of time, and under those kind of constraints where the or the governor certifies a question to the court, it could be very useful to the overall functioning of the government. And that's why I patterned this particular proposal after those that already exist in Massachusetts, Colorado, and New Hampshire. Just to examine a few, and then included in the packets are those laws from these several states. And in contacting those states, this was some time ago, people seem very happy with their laws. They're not used that frequently. But once in a while, they have a question they'd like resolved, and they certify a question to their court and get that advice. Of course, it's non-binding advice, but it certainly gives you a better idea of where your court's going to be before you try to deal with these issues. And in a nutshell, that's it.
Thank you. Carla Forsyth is here from the court system, and I'd ask Carla to join us at this time, please.
I'm Jimmy Porter. Forsyth, because at one end, I really think it's an extremely important bill, and if we could pass it out to the judiciary, it has two more committed judiciary, but it's really scrutinized.
I would like to allow Carla the opportunity to testify, and I have no objections after that. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Carla Forsyth, staff counsel to the administrative offices of the Alaska court system. Madam Chair, the Supreme Court opposes this resolution. We've been asked to bring a fiscal note with us today. I regret to say I do not have one. The court is going to be meeting tomorrow. At that point in time, we plan to discuss with them a fiscal note. We should be able to get that down to the committee in relatively short order. There are several reasons behind the court's opposition. The first, as Representative Donnelly points out, the primary work of the court is cases based on facts. And there is another reason why a factual setting is important to courts in making decisions other than preventing them from making law. It's that having cases litigated presents both sides as they come up, and courts believe this presents a better basis for relevant, rational analysis of a situation at hand. Advisory opinions, commentators consider them not to be part of a judicial function. They're really an extrajudicial function. As Representative Donnelly points out, they're not binding. They're not even regarded as a decision of the court. They're regarded as an individual decision of the individuals who happen to sit on the court. The whole concept of imposing an extrajudicial task on the courts does begin to get into the separation of powers area. Another reason for the court's opposition is a real concern that this could become, it could embroil the Supreme Court in political disputes. So many of these questions, we all know, have emotional, political, all sorts of dimensions to them. Some of the commentators say, well, this shouldn't be a problem for courts because our judges are naturally partisan creatures. They're elected in partisan elections. And of course, that's not our situation here in Alaska. Our great pains have been taken in the Constitution to remove our judges from politics. We have a merit selection system. It's a retention election, not a partisan election. The Supreme Court is quite adverse to being drawn in as a political player in that particular system. The third and final basis for the opposition is the court's workload. Our appellate courts are very, very busy right now. We've had a 30% filing increase over the last fiscal year. This is primarily attributable, as far as we can tell, to the litigation, which has resulted from more stringent criminal penalties and whatnot that the legislature has enacted over the past few years. These cases have wound their way up to the trial courts, and they're now beginning to hit the appellate courts. Our appellate court caseload is way, way up. And these are cases that do involve facts and parties and the sorts of situations in which courts normally are involved. In the court's view, asking the court to consult on an advisory basis is only going to result in delay, particularly to those cases that are already before it. So, in summary, Madam Chair and committee members, the court does oppose this resolution, and I hope to be able to provide the committee with a fiscal note as soon as possible tomorrow. I'd be glad to answer any questions. We actually technically cannot pass a resolution or a bill out without a fiscal note, so I guess we will just have to continue this to Friday in hopes that we have it by then.
Ms. Forsyth,
we do have a rule of court adopted by the Alaska Supreme Court that allows the certification of questions of law to the court from the federal court system here in Alaska. Why would this be different from that?
Through the chair, I think a primary concern is that it would be part of the political system, and that's not a procedure which has been used to any great degree. There's a real concern that we're going to see recurring political questions presented to the court over and over again, and that's just really not an appropriate role.